This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. Bill Smith's work over the years has centered on tables. He danced on them in a 1970s production of Diamond Studs, the homegrown show that would find its way to New York. Later, Smith entered a different kind of show business. He put food on tables as chef in the kitchen of the now legendary La Residence restaurant in Chapel Hill. And since the early 90s, Bill Smith has been the chef and guiding force of another Chapel Hill landmark, Crook's Corner. That restaurant, of course, led the charge into nouvelle, new Southern cuisine, mixing traditional down-home food with new ingredients and imagination. Well, Bill Smith's new cookbook, Seasoned in the South, does some mixing, too. There are, to be sure, recipes in there, but also musings about a range of subjects, such as the kitchen scraps that are a restaurant's best-kept secret, the cycles of immigrants that have come through the Crook's kitchen, and there is a whole chapter on what's called guts. Bill Smith is our guest today. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you, Melinda.
And we're taking your calls this hour. The number's 1-877-962-9862. What flavor combinations would you want to see on a plate? And what are those you never thought would work but actually do? And what is your best kitchen tip? That number's 1-877-962-9862. Well, Bill, in the introduction to this cookbook, you offer a list of ways in which nothing need be wasted in the kitchen. How you can reuse things. And you say it's almost hard to put some of that into your recipes here that
right.
you would give to the general public because they may not have those bits and pieces.
It started out, the woman that tested my recipes for me, and I was sort of chuckling about this, all this, these like drippings and scraps and bones and whatever that we use all the time because they're always around, and that it's pointless to put those in the recipes because who's got a duck blood, who's got so, but that's the little nuance that perhaps changes a recipe just a little bit for the better each time.
Yeah, did I see in here, was it dried garlic toast or?
Yes, stale garlic toast is a wonderful thing for thickening a soup.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And we would taste that only because it...
You would taste garlic and the soup would be thick, but it wouldn't taste stale, it would just be...
Because the soup is tarted it up.
Right, You've recooked it in the soup, perhaps, yeah.
Give us another example of the kind of scraps that end up.
All right, well, I said duck blood a minute ago, but this mm-hmm. morning before I came over, I was roasting bones to make duck stock. And when you open the packages of ducks, there's blood in the bottom of each bag. And most people would scream and throw it away, but I pour it in the pan to brown it up and enrich the sauce. So. Mm-hmm.
Is this from some kind of thrift on your part, or is it just the
people,
idea?
I think some people think it's just being cheap, but it's sort of it's logical. You know that the juice of things contains their flavor, and so that makes sense. It's also technique. I mean, I guess it's more French than Southern, perhaps, but you just don't waste anything. It's just a point of honor, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that in a moment when we talk about guts.
All right, yeah.
But this idea, though, of having those things on hand gets to the idea that a restaurant is a continuous process. It might close, but in the overnight hours.
True. But you couldn't do this at home, but in a kitchen that runs all the time, it's just logical, honestly, to use everything you have. And you need to think of it is an economy because you have to always think about that in a restaurant kitchen because you have people to pay and things like that. you have to make money on it.
Well, so. And the idea is kind of reinforced by the way you've set up your book, the cookbook Seasoned in the South, which has the distinctive pig on top of Crook's Corner on the cover. And you're modeling it on the calendar, a year in the kitchen, and you start out with this season, the fall.
That's when our year begins in Chapel Hill because of the university, I think. And things start stirring up again. And again, it's the logic. One thing leads to the next, sort of without even thinking about it, once you've been around it a long time. And agriculture, of course, follows the season, as does fish, really, pretty much everything. It's just once you're people ask me this all the time, and just once you're into it, you just see this logic. And I'm not sure I can explain it exactly, but it just one thing leads to the next, and the little bits of this left over lead to the next main course, you know. Not always, but often, you know.
We are talking with Bill Smith, who is the chef at Crook's Corner Restaurant in Chapel Hill. His book is called Seasoned in the South. It's a cookbook, but it also has a lot of thoughts about the idea of cooking, running a restaurant, and we'll get to those in just a moment. The number's 1-877-962-9862. Well, the fall season, we think of a very bountiful one when many, many things are coming into season. And you make the case that when one cooks, one should take into account the season, but also the place where you are.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in Central Carolina, what would you be, where Chapel Hill is, what would you be doing right now?
Well, I'll tell you what I am doing right now. a friend of mine called me, or didn't even call, she just showed up with a big basket of chestnuts, right? So we've had chestnut soup all week. Now, that'll be gone, you know, by the weekend probably, and that'll be that until the next year probably. A woman, Mary Andrews, that I've been buying things from for years, her persimmons are in, so we have persimmon pudding. And they'll be gone in a couple of weeks, and that'll be that until next fall. Winter squash are starting to come in. I've brought ducks in, like I said. That seems to me that's like a fall thing. It's too rich for hot weather. And what else?
And do ducks ducks don't go by the season. You could slaughter ducks anytime.
You could, but I sort of, you think of duck season, hunting season in the fall. Of course, we can't go out and shoot ducks because the Department of Agriculture regulates poultry and stuff. But it's sort of the time of year when people think about game, I think.
So you could not use ducks if somebody were to show up with ducks that they
No,
shot.
I would not be allowed to do that.
Is that that's because of the regs?
It's just, yeah, it has to be inspected. Okay. All meat needs to be inspected. And I certainly agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Chestnuts are okay.
Chestnuts are okay. Fish is okay. Now, fish isn't subject to the same kind of inspection that meats are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dairy is.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And ducks considered dairy?
I was just thinking about the cheese I buy. Oh, okay. I buy lots of cheese locally, and they have to meet strict regulations. The health department comes in and mm-hmm. inspects their kitchens or whatever. And
how often do you get inspected in a restaurant?
Every 3 months.
And do you have no heads up that they're coming?
Well, you know, about every 3 months. I guess you can. They don't call you, or certainly, they just show up, and you always have to be ready for them. I spend probably an hour first thing every morning just walking around, making sure everything's what it ought to be in case they show up that day. You know, mm-hmm. looking at for, you know, inspecting the silverware and checking the bleach bottles to make sure we can spray down the counters where we've worked, and I don't know, there's lots. Crawling around on the floor, looking under the stove to make sure there's not any garbage that got stuck back there from the night before. That's the first thing I do every day.
So that's the job of the chef to do that.
It is the job of the chef.
Okay. One would not think that.
Oh, no. The chef, if you can't, yeah, you got to do all that stuff. I mean, I wash pots sometimes. You know, I take out the garbage. If you can't do those things, you probably shouldn't be a chef.
We were talking a moment ago about the ingredients that go into the food there and going by the seasons. Now, you go to a farmer's market locally.
I do, the farmer market.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there's a lot to be said for it. What about those people who would be reading your book who don't live near a farmer's market? What kind of options do they have if they were to go to, you know, the standard grocery store? And
well, the grocery store food is fine, certainly. You know, I think it's just better to use the local stuff for lots of reasons. It's fresher, certainly. You keep the money in your community, which I think is important. I always say this, and I'm probably making people mad, but it's sort of like a blow against agribusiness. And I know agribusiness is a big part of North Carolina, but all the same, I prefer the, I guess I'm old-fashioned.
Well, that's the case for the farmer's market. But as far as a consumer goes, I mean, what ought they look for? Say they are living someplace that doesn't have that opportunity. They have to go with agribusiness and grocery store.
Well, most people can, I think, judge what seems fresh. I mean, you can look at a head of lettuce and tell if it's wilted or not. And you can smell things. I smell things all the time, you know. You just have to be observant, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I think most grocery stores, honestly, I mean, everything's fine in them. I'm never afraid I'm going to be poisoned or anything from a grocery store. I just prefer to use the other stuff if I can have it. And you can't do it for everything. I mean, there's no fresh local lemons in North Carolina, you know, so what do, you know?
Right.
We don't have that sort of thing. And
go for the import.
Right, yeah.
We are talking with Bill Smith, who is the chef of Crook's Corner. His book is Seasoned in the South. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. In a regular person's refrigerator, not somebody who's a chef at a great restaurant.
Oh, ask about a chef's refrigerator sometime.
Okay, well, I'll ask that in a second. Okay.
Okay.
In a regular person's refrigerator, if they had to have five ingredients in it, five condiments that you think would be essential.
All right.
What would they be?
Uh, that were going to cook all the time. I'd have butter and, oh, let's see, garlic, probably eggs, I'd probably have stock, actually. I would have made stock to keep that on hand of some kind, probably chicken because that's more versatile. One more?
Okay. If you want to.
Well, I'd probably say salt, but you won't put that in the refrigerator. yeah. And then your vegetables and meat and stuff you would buy mm-hmm. as you needed them.
Right.
Maybe, I don't know, Budweiser. I don't know.
Well, that is part of your honeysuckle sorbet recipe,
that is
as
right.
I understand. Well, tell me about the chef's refrigerator.
The chef's refrigerator, or at least this chef's refrigerator, is fairly bare. I don't cook very much at home because I cook all the time. And it has actually Budweiser and hot sauce, but nothing to put it on, and probably coffee. And I do have butter, actually. But every time I have people over, I practically have to go out and buy dishes. I mean, I just don't have time to entertain very much at home, so it's pretty threadbare. And I think it's common with lots of chefs, unless they have families, you know, children to raise or something. Then,
mm-hmm. So Bud is your beer of choice?
It is.
None of that homegrown microbrew?
No, and people
support
the local brewery thing?
Are
very put out with me about this. They think my tastes are very pedestrian in this regard, and they're always like patting my hand and say, "We'll bring you some nice beer when we come over," that kind of thing.
And what do you think of it when they do?
Oh, it's fine. Of course it is. But it's just, you know, I've been hot and thirsty for 30 years now, and you just want something fizzy and cold after work, you know, and that just hits the spot. So.
Well, this gets to something that Lee Smith, the writer Lee Smith, had written about you in the preface to the book. And she said, though he's a genius cook, Bill Smith is not really a foodie.
No, I guess I'm not.
So in your mind, what is a foodie, and why aren't you one?
Well, I think I was one once when I first began this because it was an interesting thing, but I guess I've sort of worn out on it now. It's someone that's perhaps overly obsessed with the details. I think your dinner should be something that is the centerpiece for a conversation, but not, you don't want to talk about the dinner the whole time. You just want to look down at a restaurant and say, "God, this is good, isn't it?" And then go on with what you were talking about. You know? And, you know, I don't know, just cooing over raspberries, you can only do that for so long, it's not sensible, you know. I see that food as a sort of a meeting place for other things.
So you'd like a pat on the back if somebody says, this is a really great meal, Bill.
This is great, thanks. And that's all they need to say.
But move on.
I don't want them to ask for a list of ingredients. But my mother one time, she and I were in France, and I think this proves that I was once this way, and we sat down to dinner, we had friends joining us, and we were in Paris, and she said, sort of out of the blue, "Do you think we could get through dinner without a list of ingredients, please?" And I think that made me start to think about that maybe I should back off.
Yeah. Right. So when you go out to other people's restaurants, if you were to go to France, uh-huh. and I understand you travel a lot.
I like to, yeah.
Do you try to guess what's in it?
Oh, sure. And I mean, but yeah. And sometimes if I'm really stunned by what I've just had, then I would pursue it. But, you know, it's almost sort of, but if you go around inquiring about the food people have fixed for you, it's like it verges on rude almost, you know, it's like if you want to dissect their dinner and fun, you know, I don't know. And just
right. Bill Smith is with us. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Mary joins us from Chapel Hill. Hi there, Mary. I understand you're one of the foragers.
Yeah, I'm a friend of Bill's. Hey, Bill, it's Mary Ayers.
Hey, Mary.
How are you?
I'm fine.
I just want to talk a few minutes about what Bill's been talking about. I think the beauty of what Bill does is that he runs a restaurant more like a home kitchen, and that is all about using local ingredients and making stock. And, Bill, I think that you're absolutely right. The most important thing, if anybody wants to be a good home cook, just make some stock in the wintertime and freeze it.
It's the truth.
And I worked at Crooks, unfortunately not under Bill, earlier than that, but the sensibility of the restaurant and the kitchen, I think that the beauty of it has always been that mentality that you use everything you can and that you have, by taking the time to use the scraps, you get an essence that you don't get if you just take fresh ingredients and put it together that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, what kind of foraging do you do?
Well, I haven't done it in a couple of years. I've been too busy, and unfortunately the habitat's sort of dying away, and it's been too dry this year. But I do black chanterelles, which are commonly called black trumpets.
She does.
And know a couple of good places where, in a couple of good years, I've been able just to pick gallons of them.
People ask all the time about that, too. Like, well, I'm not getting any this year. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I went out and looked today, Bill, and there aren't any. So that's really the reason I called to tell you.
Well, we'll pass that on now. People can stop bugging me about it. But people ask about that all the time.
And Melinda, that's, I think, really and truly, Bill uses the best ingredients and listens to other people, and that's what makes him a great cook.
Okay, great. Well, I hope you have a better mushroom season next year.
Me too.
Oh, yeah, unfortunately, good mushroom seasons are not really good for other things because it means it has to rain the whole time.
Oh, okay.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Mary.
Thank you for your call, Mary. 1-877-962-9862. I'd like to talk a little bit about your influences. Bill Neal, of course, who was the first chef at Cook's Corner.
Yeah.
What was the most important thing you learned from him?
He sort of approached, he actually said this one time. He told us that this was actually at La Residence we worked. I never worked with him at Crook's Corner, but this is when we were all at La Residence. This is a bazillion years ago now. But he once said, and this is really true, that he sort of saw the kitchen as something of a laboratory. And in those days, everyone was just learning all this, you know, the sort of the return to finer cooking was just coming back in the United States. I think it had received a blow after World War II when all these convenience items came in. And so that was... That just made me realize that, you can really do anything you want. It might not be any good, but you're welcome to try. And so that was probably the most important thing. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Raymond is with us from Greensboro. Hi there, Raymond.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
Fine.
Hi,
welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm calling because, and your screener got the question properly, so I may mess this up. My home is Charleston, South Carolina. And what I've discovered since I've moved to North Carolina is how horrible the food has been when someone tries to take recipes or different culinary delights from one region to the other. Quick example, in South Carolina or in Charleston, shrimp and grits, shrimp perlow, red rice, Hop and John's, those things are like the staple there. And it was funny because I went to a restaurant one night and I ordered some shrimp and grits, and this stuff was just horrible.
Now, horrible in what way?
Tasteless, had nothing to do with, and I know I'm exaggerating, it had nothing to do with shrimp and grits. There was nothing even close to the shrimp and grits taste that I had when I was growing up. And I think I'm an expert in making shrimp and grits because my grandmother and my mother made a point of keeping me on the stove. And I've had other things like shrimp perlow. Here in North Carolina, you guys call it shrimp preload. Why, I don't know. red rice and fish that we eat on Friday. It's a staple in Charleston or even on the coast, Savannah. On Fridays, you have red rice and fish, fried fish. Different things like that. On New Year's Day, Hoppin' John's. And I discovered since I moved to North Carolina and other regions, when people try to, I guess, co-opt those recipes and take its places, the food is just nasty and people are saying, oh, this is great, this is great, this is great, when you just want to scream, look, what are you doing?
Well, I'm going to put your question to Bill Smith. Do you, at risk of offending people like Raymond, mess with those recipes?
I don't know. I'm sort of speechless here. I hope that we don't do that, maybe. I don't know. I guess you're just outside of the folklore that surrounds this cooking, and you can't hope to capture it. I don't know. We have Hop and John here, too. I was raised on that myself. I think ours is pretty good, but it might not suit you. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you, though. I don't know. I was going to say you might consider it flattering that people want to try to duplicate what you're used to, but if they fail, maybe it's not flattery. I don't know.
It gets the thing of what you're accustomed to.
And what you're accustomed to, certainly. Yeah.
I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, which makes the world's best pizza. And my brother says, he lives elsewhere, he says if he eats somebody else's pie, he'll take a bite of it politely, but he will not call it pizza.
It's like
not the same thing.
My father in barbecue, same.
Yeah, yeah. So it just comes down to the name? Do you just have to give these things different names?
I don't know, perhaps not claim people that it's something else, yeah.
Well, we'll get to more of your calls. If you have a comment about food, and it seems everybody does, the number is 1-877-962-9862. We continue our conversation with Chef Bill Smith from Crook's Corner, talking about his new cookbook, Seasoned in the South, Recipes from Crook's Corner and From Home. All that just ahead, and your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pankava, and we are talking with Bill Smith. He is chef at Crook's Corner Restaurant in Chapel Hill and author of the new book, A Cookbook, Seasoned in the South. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. We go to the phones again, and Michael is with us from Seaboard. Hi there, Michael.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine. Welcome to the show. Did you have a question for Bill Smith?
Yes. I spend a lot of time traveling around the world. I go places. I try different recipes regionally. And what I've noticed is in the United States, we kind of have a dichotomy going on. We've, on one hand, we're eating more and more heavily processed food. But on the other hand, politically correct cooking is taking over, getting away from the things that make the dishes taste good. And I know especially in the South, most recipes that I see from the older cookbooks have got great ingredients like lard and bacon fat and heavy cream and butter.
I use those.
Yes. and I'm just curious as to your take. You know, first of all, how is it that so far the South has been able to resist that politically correct cooking method? And second, how do we reverse it elsewhere?
Well, like I said, I never succumbed to that, so I have no problem with that. I'm a great fan of lard, and I'm second to none in my admiration of butter, and I use it all the time. And when people are worried about that, I just point out that you're just supposed to eat one serving. You don't have to eat the whole thing. And if you just eat a spoonful or two of whatever, it's not going to kill you, clearly. People are strangely obsessed with weight in this country, and I think that has as much to do with that as anything. But I just think moderation is the key to that. And you don't see fat people in France and Italy, and they eat everything they please. And they eat a lot more often than we, I think, too.
So what do you think their secret is?
They just eat a little bit, and they don't eat junk food. I think that's the real thing. Maybe that's as much of – and I guess you need exercise as well. But I don't think you should avoid particular ingredients unless you're allergic to them or something, I guess you really don't like them. I mean,
Now, Michael, do you cook with those things?
I use them all the time, and I do find that portion control is the key. I'd rather have a little bit of something that's wonderful
than a lot
of something second-rate.
Agreed.
Okay, great. Michael, thank you for your call. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, Bill Smith, does this go back to something, another influence of yours, two other influences? You write about your grandmothers
right.
in eastern North Carolina.
Yeah.
Now, they would have cooked with butter and lard, I'm guessing?
They cooked, yeah. There was no worry about any of that.
Were there moderate portions at that dinner table?
Well, children were encouraged to stuff themselves. My aunt, Hi, would just insist that we just eat and eat and eat until you were just, like, stupefied. And they would just pat you on the back and think that was a wonderful thing. I think adults probably ate normal amounts. I don't know. No one in my family was particularly overweight. So. But yeah, they cooked. Everything they cooked was really good. And that's why I think that you should use those things. And again, just use moderation if you're afraid of weight gain or heart problems or whatever. But my first obligation, I think, is just to make good food. And then people can eat it or not. I don't know what else to say about it. But I don't really approve of like taking lard out of pie crusts and stuff. I just don't think you should. If it's better with it, you just let people who care not to have it know it's there.
Right. You write in your book. There are a number, of course, of recipes in here, but you have a chapter where you talk about the influence of some of the people in your kitchen, and not just Bill Neal, who you had worked with at La Residence, and your grandmother's way back, but waves of immigrants who have come through, who often do end up working in restaurant kitchens.
They do. That's where they start.
Such as Crook's Corner.
That's where they start often. Yeah.
And talk about some of the influences they've actually had on your cooking and changes you may have made in recipes.
Well, there's actually a lot of the influence they may have had is actually more an attitude thing. It's more than ingredients a lot of times because they exemplary work ethic. Tend not to, because they're sort of out of their league anyway, they just sort of go with the flow, try to figure out the best way to do things. Those were good lessons to learn. But besides that, right now, Mexicans are who we have the most of around here. And I think not just my cooking, but everybody's cooking has been influenced by that, because I have noticed over, particularly in the last 10 years, how people crave hotter and hotter and hotter food. And it's really astonishing, because people used to always complain about if you got too much Tabasco or too much pepper flakes. And now you never hear that, ever. I picked up a few things specifically from knowing these guys from Mexico. There's a mango salad in the cookbook that I learned from them, and I don't remember what else, a couple other things probably. I had Asian people for a while, too, and that doesn't show up so much, except that maybe just, I don't know. Like I said, I was thinking of my friend Hung, who I talk about in the book, who actually taught me how to behave myself better than how to cook, because she had just, she had been through a great deal, and she still was always very dignified and hard to ruffle, and just always had to, maybe it's her Buddhist background, I don't know, but she's a very calming influence. She's still a good friend of mine. And and she did cook for us, though. She cooked wonderful every Sunday night. This was at La Residence, not at Crook's Corner. She would come in. She was our dishwasher. I could never persuade her to cook. But on Sunday night, she would cook supper for the staff and these wonderful Vietnamese things, and took great pride in it. But I could never persuade her to come over to the stoves, you know. And she would have been a fabulous cook.
Yeah. But, yeah. You write also, you have a chapter in here called Guts.
I do.
And I'm going to quote here from part of this. You have, for those who may not know this, sweetbreads, you say, are not sweet and they have nothing to do with bread, that most other innards are called by their name, but for some reason the thymus gland of the calf is named euphemistically. How did it, do you know how it got
named
sweetbreads?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's an old term. I had my grandmother's friends, I remember years, this is years ago, when I first discovered sweetbreads, because I had not seen them growing up. But my grandmother's friends talked about, oh, we used to always have those for breakfast, they said.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, tell us how you'd prepare them.
A couple of ways. You start out the same way, in that you poach them in some seasoned broth, and then you chill them, and then you press them under some kind of something heavy, and then you peel them, and then I like to do them two ways. One's a French way, and that's with you roll them in eggs and breadcrumbs, and then you do some burn butter with capers and lemon juice right at the last second. And then another way is more of a Southern way, where I start off the same way. I brown them in butter again, and then I hit the pan with a little bit of like wild turkey liqueur or something like that, and then a little cream, maybe some mushrooms.
Is this one of these things where it's a delivery system for those other things you just described? and you do advise that people who make this don't tell people what they're eating until after it's over.
Well, I guess if it's a vegetarian, you wouldn't do that to them. But if it's just a person that is squeamish, perhaps you should. I don't know. We have people call me all the time. They know I serve them only in cold weather because they're sort of rich. And like people stop me in the grocery store, are the sweetbreads yet? You know, yeah. or people call up to see when they're going to be on the menu. And there's a whole like a sweetbread club that shows up, you know.
Right. Well, we go to the phones, 1-877-962-9862, and Leslie's with us. Hi there, Leslie.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm having a great fun listening to his discussion, and I was thinking about, I spent a long time working in kitchens, and after I finished, I discovered something when I was at home using up leftovers that I thought, man, I wish I had known this when I was doing brunch, because what I did was chop up some leftover bacon and put it in my pancakes. And I know when I'm eating pancakes in a restaurant, you know, the syrup will get on your bacon and that's or your sausage, and that's really good. When you put the bacon in the pancakes, that's just really good.
It sounds great.
It's awesome with maple syrup.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a great way to use up leftover brunch, breakfast stuff.
Excellent.
So I just wanted to pass that on.
Well, thanks.
Do you think someday that'll end up in a fast food restaurant because it's all in one?
Well, I think that could happen. I just know that we eat them up.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, thanks for the call, Leslie.
Yeah, have fun. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bill Smith, honeysuckle sorbet.
Uh-huh.
And this is aforementioned Budweiser involved
right.
in this.
Well, yeah.
But the bud doesn't actually go into
the sorbet. Not into the sorbet. That's just the comfort for the chef, actually. That's it's something, it took a couple of years to figure it out. Gene Hamer, my boss, we had a big, huge honeysuckle bush beside the restaurant. And in the summer, you know how it smells. You smell it. And he kept saying, can't you make something to eat out of this? And I kept thinking, well, I don't know. A lot of times flowers don't taste good. But I knew honeysuckle tastes good because you grow up, you know, chewing on the end of them. And finally, I got around to investigating it. And I found in a old Italian cookbook a recipe that the Arabs had left in Sicily for a jasmine ice. And so I read that, and I took it and sort of applied it to honeysuckle. It took a while. It took a couple of years because I could not remember to write down what I had done from year to year. And I, the next year would start, I'm like, okay, what did you do? Why did you not write that down? So after about 3 years of this, I wrote it down and paid attention every time I made it, and now it works. And it's just, I don't know, it's just one of those things that you just invent. I don't know, I think it's probably the only thing I've really invented, honestly. I don't.
And the Budweiser comes into this in terms of harvesting the honeysuckle.
It is that. That's true. That's sort of a staff joke, but it was true. I can't deny it. What I would do is when the aroma is released at night, you know, you notice that at night it's much stronger. So after work at night, I would take a couple of beers and go out and drink beer and pick flowers until the beer was gone. And that was how much sorbet I would make. And I still do that sort of, but that bush has been chopped down, unfortunately. I have to go down the bike trails now. So you have to be careful drinking beer in public, I guess.
But. And how many honeysuckle flowers do you need, say, to make a quart of honeysuckle sorbet?
Well, the least amount that's worthwhile is 4 cups. And you can't have any leaves in it, so it's got to be all flowers.
No, so all pestle.
Yeah.
And so on. Wait.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Smith, thank you for coming in to talk with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Yeah.
Bill Smith is the chef at Crook's Corner Restaurant in Chapel Hill, and he is author of the new book. It's called Seasoned in the South, and he reads tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh at 7 p.m.